Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
Aaron lives in California, and Trishul lives in Pennsylvania, and it feels like Trishul's vote for the president is worth more than Aaron's. In this episode, they discuss the American voting system and how it influences and incentivizes certain behaviors over others. They consider alternative voting structures used around the world and examine past elections to understand how they may have played out with a different system in place. The purpose of a voting system is to provide the most accurate representation of what the electorate wants. But is it even possible to implement something better given all the conflicts of interest involved? And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
Great to be here as well. As I just mentioned, I'm in the Bay Area, and I'm in California. Trishul is on the East Coast, specifically in Pennsylvania. And one of the things that we've talked about, just kind of casually off to the side, is a lot of what our conversations have been about over the last few weeks have some political ramifications. And there's this really big election coming up in November. And one of the things that kind of, it was left unsaid, and we're going to kind of make that part said now, is because I'm in California, I am really, really confident that the electoral votes for California are going to go to Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee for president. But because Trishul is in Pennsylvania, he doesn't actually know where his electoral votes will go. He's in one of those swing states. And so does that imply that Trishul's vote is more important than my vote? This also reminded me of a joke that I heard about two economists happened to meet each other at the polls, at the voting booths. And one says to the other, "What are you doing here?" It's like, "Yeah, my wife guilted me into voting this year. I know my vote doesn't matter." The other economist says, "Yeah, mine too." And I don't really like the joke because it does come off a little sexist, but it does point out the idea that when you look at the math, and economists tend to be very rational, the ability for a single vote to influence an election at such a large scale doesn't really play out. That the result, again, like my vote in California isn't going to change anything. But even Trishul's vote in Pennsylvania, it's just one of so many votes that it's not going to be an issue. But there is this impact of leadership and rhetoric, and you do get these large waves where enough of these individual votes can make a difference. So today we're just going to kind of talk about voting in general, taking a look at voting in the U.S., taking a look at other voting possibilities that we could do. I don't know if we ever will get there, but we're just kind of going to have fun with this idea that does Trishul's vote matter more than mine just based on where he lives? So Trishul, when you first think of voting and voting systems, what is the first thing that comes to mind for you?
To begin, it makes me just think about how we got to where we are. And it ties back to the form of government we have. We, as a government, have a form of democracy, not a pure democracy where everybody votes on every little thing that we like to do. But we have this form of democracy known as a representative democracy, where we vote for representatives. And the representatives go off and they do what they want to do, hopefully according to what we want them to do. But what that also means is we use these representatives in this committee type of structure known as the Electoral College to actually place the votes for the president. And it's kind of weird how this all came about. If my understanding is correct, it's basically, it was hard in the 1800s to collect a bunch of votes and simultaneously figure out who would be counted as the president. And, you know, just logistically, there wasn't internet, so you had to physically go to a location and select a representative, and that representative could then go to the national congregation of representatives to elect the president. So that's kind of why it happened, but stuck around for, you know, these couple hundred years. So here we are. And to highlight just a little more about the Electoral College itself, it's the notion that the president is not decided by a popular vote. It's decided by a majority vote in terms of the number of electors. And the number of electors is determined by looking at the total number of representatives in the Senate, 100, and the total number of representatives in the House of Representatives, 435. Plus, we add an extra 3 for the District of Columbia, and we get 538. So these 538 votes hopefully decide on a majority basis who becomes our president. And as we may have heard, every now and then, there can be dislocations between the majority vote and the actual president, as determined by the majority of the electors, as happened in 2016.
So when you first think of that, when because I do agree, the Electoral College made a lot of sense, especially when it came to logistics, that you, if you have to actually spend several days traveling from one state to a centralized location to count the votes, it makes sense that you just send your representative of that state and they pass those ballots, or even a few based on how many electoral votes you have. And so that makes sense to me. Do you have issue with the Electoral College system now, or do you have issue with the apportionment of representatives in the Senate and the House of Representatives? The idea that the House of Representatives is based on population, so the states with the larger populations have more representatives, but the Senate is 2 senators per state. And so you get a few states where the populations are so low that they only have 1 representative in the House, but 2 senators, and that can give those state populations 3 electoral votes, even though based on their population, they may, that gives them an inordinate amount on a kind of percentage basis. So at your first kind of take, when you think about Electoral College, is it the Electoral College aspect of states choosing representatives and the combination of those, or is it the how many senators versus how many representatives each state gets? So I guess my question is, if electoral votes were based just on the House of Representatives, which is population-based, would that take care of a lot of the concerns that you have?
It might go some ways. I mean, we're talking about voting in this particular episode. So to kind of understand where we may want to go with a voting system, the high-level goal is to provide the most accurate representation of what the citizens or the electorate want to do. So that's kind of the goal of the system. And there were some shortcuts that were taken by the Electoral College to make things easier back then. And it seems like there might be a better way to have our current electoral system modified so that it more accurately represents the views of the voters. And, you know, as you suggest, it might make sense to have it maybe based off of just the House of Representatives, which is more population-based. But at the end of the day, you know, we do have more sophisticated systems at our disposal than we did 200 or 300 years ago. So maybe it makes sense to just count the popular vote and have that be a more important factor.
I do like your phrasing there. I almost want you to repeat it. So the purpose of voting or an election is to get an accurate representation of what the electorate wants. Did I get that correctly?
Yeah.
I like that. So, okay. So if, and I can see if that is the goal, I do kind of agree that then going with a popular vote makes more sense, especially if we now have the technology that logistics are no longer concerns. One of the things I do think about, I believe you have more information on this than I do, but when we have, it works, it has worked well, like that's an easy thing to say when it's just two candidates. So when you come down to, you choose A or B, or you choose red or blue, and we can now have a majority of the population will come out for one of those two candidates. And so it's fairly easy to measure, yes, 51% of the population wants this person. But what happens when there are lots of people running for president, or especially lower down when we go through the primary system of multiple candidates, and if we had a plurality? And so the example, it sometimes comes up with things like MVP voting in sports, but if you had 30% of the population prefers this one Democrat, 30% of the population prefers a second Democrat, and 40% of the population prefers a Republican, 60% of the population preferred a Democrat, or sometimes it has like a good player on this one team, and sometimes you see it's called kind of splitting the vote, where the most votes went to that particular Republican. How do you feel that a popular vote system would absolve that? Would that accurately capture the wishes and desires of the electorate? And if not, what are some of the ideas that we could use?
Right. You do highlight a central concern with our current system. So we begin with this notion that there might be some patent concerns with the Electoral College. And typically what that means is, yes, my vote in Pennsylvania, sorry, Aaron, may be worth more than your vote in California, because as you mentioned in the intro here, there's a very unlikely chance that California will go in a direction that's not predicted, whereas Pennsylvania here is a swing state. And the concern is that you have these handful of swing states where that's where most of the campaigning is done, and the rest of the country, since it's so solidly one way or the other, it doesn't really make a difference in terms of appealing to those districts. And that represents a large proportion of the country, but they may get little, you know, airtime or a little pandering from these candidates. Well, so at the end of the day, yeah, if we had a majority system, then, you know, one vote would go a lot further, and Aaron, your and my vote would be more equal or on par with each other. But then you're right, it highlights another concern, meaning if you have that case where you have three candidates and one candidate doesn't have a majority, but they have the most number percentages of votes, they could end up controlling everything, even though in a slightly different, or even though if you add up the actual percentages of what people likely want, it's against what that largest majority party is going for. Just to put a little vocabulary behind all this, the system that we have in the US is known as something called the first past the post system, meaning not the majority candidate, you don't have to have a majority, but the one with just the most votes in terms of percentage wins the whole pie. And the concern, as you highlight, is that you could have something not even close to a majority, and you could still be elected president. And if you add up, you know, like the political leanings of the losers, well, they might actually be the majority, but they might have zero representation, you know, in the executive branch. So this is kind of termed as the notion of wasted votes, meaning if you don't vote for the person who's second in place, meaning if you vote for that third party candidate, you're basically voting against the second party. And if you're aligned with that second party, you're voting against yourself. So it turns out that you may be getting a less fair outcome. You know, if that high level goal that we mentioned is to have a system that provides the ability to elect officials that most represent the electorate, then the first past the post system doesn't do well in this regard with wasted votes. It also kind of encourages this notion of gerrymandering, as we kind of have heard every now and then, where you can divide up a district so that if you're in charge, you get to say all the small majority required to win the entire state, for example, are within this little squiggly lined box over here. And then everybody else is in this other larger area, but that smaller squiggly line box has just enough votes to give me the first past the post. And that can just lead to, again, a more exaggerated form of outcomes where a majority of the population may just have a minority representation, which is kind of against the whole premise that we're kind of going for with voting.
So I believe this is a political theory idea that political parties, especially that tends to be a two-party system, have kind of evolved in response to that first past the post idea. And in the example I brought up where that 30% of Democrats, 30% of Democrats and 60% Republican, there have been historical examples where they've tried to be true viable third parties, and they tend to evolve where the two larger part, two of the parties will kind of combine on enough issues and agreement to drown out the third party. And you get this, it feels weird to think in terms of liquids, but the idea that as they combine and move around, you end up, even if you have a viable third party, you end up getting back to the two-party system in big part in response to the idea that you're trying to get to that 51%. That it's, that ends up being more important than kind of having the viable multiple parties or multiple philosophies. And so I do think that it's not quite the same as gerrymandering, but I do think that the two-party system has evolved in response to the first-past-the-post voting structure. And I don't know if kind of other modern voting structures existed when the U.S. Constitution was written, but there are newer voting structures that could allow for multiple parties on multiple issues without having that issue. And it doesn't necessarily solve the gerrymandering case, but it actually might a little bit as well. So one of the ideas that comes to mind is called ranked choice voting. And it's most popularly known with the college football ranking system, where you choose your top 10, or they usually do 25, and the number one team that you choose gets 25 votes. The number two team you choose gets 24. It goes all the way down to 25th. And now that tends to take care of the number one team isn't just the team that got the most vote or the most first place votes, because you might have, again, they got 40% of the first place votes and two other teams split 30% of first place votes, 30% of first place votes. So even though they got the most first place votes, if 60% of them, again, the majority of the population, consider them the third or fourth best team, and the 60% of the population consider the other two teams either one or two, that would more likely outweigh, and we, again, if we're trying to determine those top two teams, you could see a situation where the team with the most first place votes actually finished in third, because the majority of the votes for that team were third or fourth, and the majority of overall votes for first or second went to two teams that only got 30% of those first place votes. So that's the ranked choice voting is a way to have more than two viable options, and it does a little more accurately capture the desires of the electorate. But then you start to get into concerns like what I just mentioned, the team with the most first place votes finished in third. And how do we feel about that system? So one, I want to get your opinion on ranked choice voting, but also other types of voting structures and some of their pros and cons.
What you present is a good alternative to the first past the post. For example, I think a good case study is the 2000 presidential election where you had Gore versus Bush. Mm-hmm. If we recall, that ended up being a very close election. And many of the concerns that we've raised so far kind of highlight how these types of issues can kind of define the fate of who actually gets elected. So in that election, you had it come down to one swing state, Florida. So all of a sudden, again, we realized with the Electoral College, it's down to just one state that kind of really mattered. And if we look at the popular vote was for Gore, who had about 51 million-ish, and Bush, who ended up winning the presidency because he won Florida, had about only 50.5 million, so about 500,000 less. However, now that we're just talking about one swing state deciding the fate of the election, if you look at that swing state, it actually only came down to less than 600 votes. So that's what decided the fate of the entire country. And even more in line with the concerns that we just mentioned with first past the post is we had three parties in that state, Republicans, the Democrats, and the Green Party. So the problem with first past the post, as we mentioned, is all the votes for anyone other than the runner-up, you know, the person who comes in second, are basically votes for the winner, meaning anybody who voted for the Green Party, even though they may have not wanted to, they in theory elected Bush. So the way that election turned out is you had a perfect storm of not only was the popular vote represented, but within that electoral vote, the first past the post led to a solution that a ranked choice voting would likely have landed on differently. So you can see how these situations lead to an outcome that can decide the fate of a decade, in this case, of how things end up turning out. It's nice to see that there is an option like ranked choice where you have the ability to make things a little more in line with, again, what the electorate is going for, the desires of the electorate. This ranked choice system is also known as majoritarian system, meaning whoever wins that ranked choice, they end up
having the majority of the votes in theory, because you're down to the candidate that ends up getting the most checkboxes next to their name. It can be done in a two-round system as well, instead of a one-round system where basically you have five candidates and then you just take the top two, and then in the next round, the top two face off each other and you vote again, and then all of a sudden you, of course, have a majority, I would hope.
Yeah.
So
aren't there a few countries that do that now, I believe?
Yeah, there are many countries with the instant runoff system, which is just one round, and then there are many with the two-round system. So it's possible to do this. The two-round system is being used by probably like 80, 90 countries at this point. And it's a way to handle it where the reason first past the post was probably initially invented is it's very simple, right? There's nothing too complicated. You just vote, tally it up, and it requires a little more initiative to get one of these ranked choice systems in place, but it certainly is possible. Again, we have flying cars now, so it shouldn't be too hard.
One of the first times I felt old was with a former coworker. Someone had made a hanging Chad joke, and she honestly had no idea what we were talking about. And I had to actually like explain the counting of the physical ballots for the election in Florida in 2000. And by the time I explained it, like, the jokes lost all its humor. But that was one of those times where I realized, oh yeah, there are people who are young enough that they have no idea what that means.
It was a crazy time, and as we mentioned, it even came, or as we didn't mention, but what we could mention is that election came down to a decision that was decided by the Supreme Court on whether to count a certain subset of votes, and that came down to one Supreme Court justice. So it got even more crazy.
I was just pulling up the data. Even looking at the popular vote, it looks like while Gore won the popular vote, he only got 48.4%. No one actually got above 50 plus one.
That's right.
Ralph Nader, the Green Party, looks like he took 2 or 3%.
Right, yeah. And it might be fair to say that 2 or 3% might be more in line with what Al Gore's platform than George Bush's platform.
That's quite true. Yeah. So in our example now, instead of it's 30-30-40, it was like, if we did electoral votes, I'm going to do some quick math. Now, because Nader never won an electoral vote, but it's possible that the Green Party, like you said, the Green Party votes in Florida, if they had gone to Gore, that might have given him the electoral votes from Florida, which would have given him the victory.
Right.
So if kind of combining electoral college and runoff system, if Florida only allowed for two candidates or had a runoff system, then Florida might have gone towards Gore and given him the Electoral College win.
Right. And, you know, it's probably even more pronounced in the 2016 election, where you had 57% of the electoral votes going to Trump, but he only won about 46% of the popular vote.
Yeah. So that does point out, like, the math can get that far off. I'm guessing that's an outlier in terms of history, that there have been enough times where the popular vote has had a different result than the Electoral College. That's not unusual, but it's usually something like one candidate gets 49% of the popular vote, another candidate gets 48%, and then a third candidate who would have been in line with the second candidate got 3%. So something like that. And that was enough to affect it in terms of first past the post, but not, but electorally, it was probably more of that three electoral votes going to Montana, Wyoming, Alaska, and several other states that only have one representative.
Right.
Okay, so we have first past the post. We have the ranked choice. We said it's majoritarian. Is that the name of the system?
Yeah.
Right. We could do multiple rounds of voting where we're narrowing down from multiple down to two. Is there anything else that you think of when it comes to possible voting systems or structures?
Well, there's a third major system out there that perhaps deserves a little more attention. This is known as proportional representation. And the idea here is you can come up with a way so that each candidate or party, for example, based upon the percentage of votes they receive, they get that percentage of representation within the elected body. So a way to kind of do that is, for example, if 5% of the electorate support a particular party, well, that political party gets 5% of the seats, you know, in air quotes, of a parliament or something like that. And it's a way to kind of set it up so that you get at least some representation from these smaller parties, where, as we saw, you might get zero representation for smaller parties, even though they could make up a good percentage of the population with the current system.
Could you give either example or a little more depth? Like how would percentage of power work? I guess it only have to be in a large body like an actual parliament.
Kind of, sort of. And so the way it kind of works it with many of these systems is you have these political party lists. So each political party has a list of candidates kind of ranked. Let's say there's 100 seats in a Congress or a parliament or whatnot. And you just kind of, depending on the percentage of votes that go to a given party, they get those many seats starting from their highest preference to the, you know, whatever makes the cutoff, right? And given that, then you can elect the, you know, the president by having a majority from the amount of seats in Congress that has, you know, the most representation. And what that might allow is, for example, a coalition to form between two smaller parties that are represented in Congress, meaning, you know, in this case, the Democrats and the Nader, the environmentalists could, you know, team up. Their two parties could team up in this fake parliament to have a majority to represent in as the president. So that's kind of how it might work in this fictitious example, but many forms of this kind of exist throughout the world.
Okay, so if the Florida election we were talking about, it was for the Senate as opposed to the president, then we might have something like 49 Republican senators, 48 Democrat senators, and 3 Green Party senators. And therefore, on kind of some of the overlap between Green Party voters and Democrat Party voters, they are likely to be in line with Democrats, but probably not everything. And so there, so you might see that Green Party, you know, it's such a small amount, that 3%, if they're not always aligned with Democrats, they could sometimes align with Republicans. And that's enough to kind of change policymaking within that body.
Right. Yeah. So it's a way to perhaps inch a bit closer. So the overarching concern with the current system is it may give higher influence to larger or to not the majority political party, because you don't need a majority, but the largest political party. So if you have five political parties and the largest just happens to only have 26%, well, 26%, that largest political party in some of these more inferior systems may control 100% of the lawmaking ability within a country.
I see. Going back to the first past the post issue of a plurality that, yeah, if they are just a little bit more than the next smallest party, they're far from a majority, but the system and the structure rewards them for being slightly bigger.
Right. And, you know, the criticism of the proportional is, well, it gives a little more power to the smaller parties. And that might be a concern, especially if you're part of the larger parties. So that's just something to understand. And maybe having more parties might lead to more fractured representation. But, you know, it's one of those things where if the goal is to have more representative representation, then that might be the way to go.
That's interesting. This is definitely kind of getting more complex, especially as I think about what might be practical, what might be able to be implemented, either in terms of kind of current political environment or logistics. Like I could see the U.S. moving to a popular vote decides the president, because it's relatively easy to measure. I think that they would probably continue with the primary system. And the primary system, again, has evolved to take care of that issue I described earlier, where you have 30% of the population likes one Democrat, 30% of the population likes a second Democrat. As long as they can come to an agreement before the election, so again, they have that primary, then they can theoretically coalesce to have that 60% majority over the 40%. And so I think the primary system is definitely evolved in response to the first past the post voting structure. So I don't think changing to a popular vote wins the president would actually change much of the U.S. in terms of logistics. I think that it would still be a primarily two-party system. It's probably still see the primary structure. I could see maybe the parties adopting rules that have multiple rounds of voting, where it allows them to get to two candidates fairly quickly, and then the entire party can choose between those two candidates. In part because I don't think I'm not a lawyer, not a political scientist, but so I'm guessing a little bit, but I think it would be in part because they can kind of write their own rules in terms of how their votes decide their party's candidate, as opposed to the laws written for how votes determine president and every other elected official. So I could see if the U.S. moved to a popular vote, logistics wouldn't be that difficult. Political parties wouldn't be that difficult. It would fit in with the current political structure fairly well. But the political parties could move to some kind of multi-round system that we see in other countries. That I could see. What do you think in terms of what might be actually implemented, or at least feasible to be implemented, of the different voting structures we've talked about?
Well, it's perhaps about incremental, you know, progress. It's always good to make small steps in a direction that's sensible. So what's actually going on is something known as the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. That's the NPVIC. So it's actually an agreement that already exists today with a group of U.S. states and the District of Columbia. And the compact is to essentially award all the electoral votes to whichever presidential candidate receives a popular vote. So this would maybe obviate the need to for the federal government to switch to the popular vote. It's a way to kind of do it in a roundabout way, but it would kind of accomplish a similar goal. And the idea is that with enough states, allow the ability for the popular vote to eventually decide the outcome of who becomes president. And this is kind of tied back to because the way that the electoral system is set up, in fact, there's a notion that each state has their own rules of deciding how their electoral votes get distributed among the candidates. And typically it's just done based upon a representation of if a given state votes it by a majority for one particular candidate, that candidate will get all of the electoral votes for that state. But there are other examples of how that's done besides first past the post.
I think there's two or three states that proportion out their electoral votes.
Right. So yeah, there are some states that say you get only a proportion of the electoral votes depending on the proportion that you won. So it's a way to provide a little more fairness. Now, this initiative, which the MPVIC, it's just a different way of going about it that says, well, we're just going to look at the entire popular vote and let that lead the decision. And according to the federal government, you can do this because, in fact, you're allowed to based upon the Constitution. So the Constitution actually doesn't specify the notion of pledging, meaning if your state is said to have a popular first past the post vote for candidate X, that you actually have to, the elector actually has to vote for that candidate. In fact, there's this notion that you can have a faithless elector, meaning that elector can show up in Washington and vote for something completely different. That's actually allowed. There's no federal law or constitutional statute that binds that elector's vote to anything, in fact. So it's kind of something that's managed at the state level. And even in the last election, you had examples of where you had some electors who went against what their state had kind of told them to do based upon the first past the post. So it's something that's possible. And basically what's happening is the states are saying, okay, we're going to try to do our best to push through this popular vote notion at a state level. And if enough states get on board, then we're kind of good to go. And so far out of the total amount of electoral votes out there, 196 have enacted this pact. So we're quite close to the 270 that you need. In fact, there are 64 pending. So only a handful of more states are required to kind of flip to this side of the fence, and we might actually have a national vote pretty soon.
That's really interesting. I kind of like hearing that. Again, it's one of those things where getting laws changed can be slow and burdensome and sometimes difficult, but within the law, understanding it, actually changing the way people work based on the current laws, people tend to be fairly creative. So I do kind of, it's one of those little things that does make me optimistic for our society that I think we could get there without necessarily having to go through the amendment process of affecting the United States, because that's almost one of the intents, was that the states get to decide how they apportion their votes. And that's a big part of just the foundation of the country. So I do kind of like that idea of the states making their own change without any federal government either influence or intervention.
Right. And it just kind of adds integrity to the voting system as a whole. In this country, we always keep saying how voter turnout is low and how underrepresented populations tend to vote less. And part of the reasons is the system seems to have these flaws that hopefully we can overcome. Something recent, for example, is there's been a lot of controversy around mail-in voting. And the concerns that we've kind of see fly across social media here and there is that there could be a big amount of fraud with mail-in voting, and that's been causing a lot of people concern.
I thought I'd seen that mail-in voting and the fraud was extremely low. Like it's on like 0.0000% and far less than any margin of victory ever. I again, might just be the difference between kind of social media and more reputable sources.
Well, yeah, it's actually quite interesting because when that information came out and started circulating, there was a good amount of concern. But in fact, what came soon after that is an issue or a memorandum from the Office of Intelligence. And what this federal government office actually ended up finding is that it was Russia who was putting out a lot of this information, trying to sow distrust in our electoral process. They said Russia is likely to continue seeking to undermine faith in the U.S. elections. And the memo basically asserts that Russia is likely to continue amplifying these types of criticisms of mail-in, mail-by-vote, and other types of voting during the pandemic to, again, try to undermine our elections. We understand that they, as been shown by many congressional reports and many federal reports, the Russians had a good influence on the 2016 elections with various social media campaigns as well. So all of this kind of highlights how integrity in the process of voting also is an important factor to consider so that we can all have fair elections that we kind of agree upon.
So going down that path just a little bit, in the pact across the states to vote for the popular vote, to apply their electoral college votes to the popular vote winner, which again, we don't need all the states. We just need the 270 electoral votes. If we get enough states to make that agreement and do that 270, then that would be enough where the popular vote does decide the winner. Is there an agreed upon process for understanding what the popular vote actually was? Like, let's say it starts to get closer. Is there a kind of single agreed upon resource, or is it just kind of using the current voting system, voting structure of everyone applying their current vote totals, their current counts to a single location? I guess it's almost like going back to what happened in Florida of like, how do we actually count the votes so that California agrees Florida counted their votes correctly?
Right. So one of the big concerns that always flies across the wires every now and then is there are concerns with voting systems. You would think after, you know, a couple of thousand years, we'd probably have this hammered down by now. But some of the main concerns are that sometimes there's jurisdictions that rely on machines, and sometimes these machines might be easily compromised, and then it might also be possible that these machines don't have paper trails. So without paper trails, then it's hard to do recounts. So there's certainly plenty of these types of concerns. It's been talked about to have things more online and whatnot, but that might lead to other security concerns, individuals having their accounts hacked and whatnot. So it seems like we're still struggling in our infancy of voting to try to get past some of these basic concerns.
Our infancy of voting a couple hundred years in.
Yeah, just 2000 and change years.
Yeah. No, I've seen similar concerns that like an online voting would be very susceptible to hacking and especially foreign influence. But the voting by mail should be fairly secure. Again, maybe it's because we have that paper trail, because we have that ability to do that recount, whereas a pure online vote, we wouldn't.
Yeah, so to kind of combat these concerns, I did see something that kind of passed my inbox recently, and it's that the U.S. Postal Service actually filed a patent for blockchain-based voting. So I found that actually quite novel, and I feel like based upon my really novice understanding of blockchain, it might actually make sense.
I can see that. That actually, so it's, we're not going to go into our Bitcoin discussion today, but I have seen that the blockchain technology could be revolutionary, again, because you kind of have that agreed upon single location. It's a decentralized, agreed upon, trustworthy source. Just based on the way the technology works, that everyone can see what all the transactions were, what all the votes were. That's interesting. I can see that being a true, legitimate, great, widespread use of blockchain that has nothing to do with Bitcoin.
Yeah, so it's good to understand that blockchain and Bitcoin are kind of related, but it's good to understand the differences. So blockchain is the technology, and Bitcoin uses that technology as a currency. So blockchain itself is just this notion of you have something known as a public ledger. And the public ledger is just as any ledger is, it's a group of transactions. But it's public, so everybody can see it. The only main differences are that public ledger is encrypted, so you have to be able to decrypt it to understand who the transactions go to. But that's possible by having individuals have a code to see, you know, if that transaction is theirs or not. So you can tell if your vote is in there and what the outcome of that vote is in that ledger. But the novel thing is that ledger is replicated all over the world many thousands of times. And to figure out what the correct ledger is, well, you just take the average outcome of all the ledgers, and whichever outcome is the majority, that's the true one. So you can't hack, you know, one computer or two computers. You'd have to hack more than half of the computers holding this public ledger. And that's really hard to do. So that's why this type of technology for voting might make a lot of sense.
I like that. Okay, so I'm now on board with blockchain is the voting of the future. I do think we'll get to a popular vote, whether it's through federal law or it sounds like it's through this multi-state pact. Maybe some of the primaries or political parties can implement other like multiple rounds of voting. That's possible. I can also see that type of voting working a little better at smaller elections. So just local city governments, or maybe for your congressperson. So that could be a way to mitigate gerrymandering a little bit. Anything else that you can think of when in terms of how voting works today or what it might look like in the future that might be a practical implementation? Anything else you want to finish off on?
Well, it seems like there are initiatives that are kind of inching forward in the right direction. For example, I believe there is one state that has some sort of ranked voting for understanding where the electoral votes might end up. I'll include that in the show notes for the president, that is. And I think it might make sense to understand that why are these changes taking so long to kind of unravel? And it's an interesting kind of moral hazard that we're running into with it, with all of this. It's the fact that in order to change the voting system, you have to rely on the politicians, and the politicians aren't likely to change the voting system if the old voting system is what got them elected. So you have this crazy catch-22 system where what do you do now when the people who ended up being voted into the office are the ones who get to change the laws to make things more fair, if making things more fair would mean that they wouldn't get elected next time.
Well, that's a bit of a downer. But that makes a lot of sense. It's also kind of reminds me of the just general sentiment of, you take polls, everyone in the country hates Congress, but everyone loves their congressperson. That you always run into issues like that of, even if they kind of made voting more fair, you'll see that, I think when it comes to politics, incentives matter. I think it's actually just a lot of human behavior. And right now there's a lot of incentives for politicians to raise money because it helps them get reelected if that's their goal. But I do think that however we change the incentive structure, we have to figure out the ideal incentive structure to align politicians' interests with the desires of the electorate.
Yeah, I think the whole notion of incentives is certainly an interesting topic in economics in general, but when you apply it to politics and legislation and voting, I think that's certainly an area that is probably for another podcast, but we could certainly dig into at some point.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Trishul. I like the idea of exploring just the voting structure and both a little bit how we got here and what it might look like moving forward.
Well, good stuff, Aaron. I enjoyed today's conversation, and thanks everybody for listening. If you enjoyed what you're hearing, do spread the word. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical, as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.